Welcome, everyone. It's a pleasure to have Alex and Colin from the Max Planck Institute for Gravitational Physics in Hanover with us today for a joint seminar on a recent exciting LIGO event, GW 1905-21, that triggered quite a number of papers and gave rise to speculations. And so we're looking forward to hear from you guys about your analysis of this event. So please take it from here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having us come and just discuss about this. There's obviously a recent paper we put on the preprint on the archive and have submitted for review. Today, we're going to be talking about a little bit just to summarize some of the current observations and the discovery of GW 1905-21 in general. Which is an especially interesting event in a couple metrics. Obviously, it's the highest massed one, but there's also this sort of possible EM counterpart that was observed. We'll discuss a little bit about how gravitation wave inference is done, how you do model selection, and then look at some of the sort of unexpected results that we've seen and what the implications are for how these sources might have formed. And what the implications are for the observed electromagnetic flare. And finally, we'll touch on how our results compare to some of the other results, especially from the LIGO and Virgo collaboration, and some possible sources of systematic error. So to start off with, I think it's just some introduction. I think most people are going to be very familiar with all of this, so I don't need to go into, I think, great detail here. But one of the things I really want to emphasize is that, I mean, the gravitational wave community is really maturing in several ways. One, it's becoming a fairly large field, and there's a sort of growing network of instruments that are observing. I would be remiss if I didn't mention, of course, the detector GEO-600 that we have here just outside of Hanover, although obviously it's quite limited in its sensitivity compared to the others. But I feel like it deserves a shout out, mainly because it's nearby me. But really critically, we have the two LIGO detectors and the Virgo ones, which have been observing for the past two observing rounds together, and then LIGO did one before that on its own. And coming up soon, we'll have a fourth sensitive detector, Kagra. It'll be obviously in sort of a very initial configurations when it first comes online, but down the line, we expect it to possibly catch up, and it could be quite an interesting complement. And even future, obviously, there's the LIGO India detector, which is still being sort of constructed. I think many people have probably seen these images before, but this is a picture of Hanford and LIGO Livingston, which is in a nice swamp, really. Virgo. And what I want to do is just summarize some of the kind of things they've been doing over the past few years. Since the first observing run, which started all the way back in 2015 now, so we're coming on a little more than 5 years now of really serious gravitational wave astronomy. We had this first observing run, which really had a fantastic observation really right off the bat with GW 1905-14. And I think from many people's perspective, it was already kind of an unusual event. I mean, one, we get lucky in having such a loud signal, but it was also somewhat larger masses than many people had predicted for many of the black holes. Now, most of that's coming from observational bias from sort of X-ray binaries. And I probably will get scolded if I don't mention that there were, of course, people who did predict sources sort of in this mass range. But I think it's fair to say that many of us we're thinking that we might see something more typical that corresponded to what other people had observed in electromagnetic information. Now, this really expanded fairly greatly with the second observing run. This is where Virgo joined the network, and it's where we had the first observation of a binary neutron star merger that was observed with a huge number of electromagnetic instruments, and then of course also with neutrino observatories and cosmic ray. Now, the third observing run has just been released. In fact, I would suspect that many of you probably listened in to the presentations by the LIGO and Virgo collaborations just earlier today. So maybe some of you are just coming out of that. So a lot of stuff I'm going to say in the next couple minutes will be just a brief refresh of that. But the thing to remember here is that this is really just the first half of this data set. There's another half of that data set, which has already been collected. I think we all know what's going to be in that data set. But it's, you know, we're only kind of going to see half the story right now. Now, what is that story? Well, first of all, we're rapidly seeing a growing population of sources. Just with O3, the total number of events is roughly up to 50 observed mergers, the vast majority of which are binary black holes. So far, there's been the one observed 1708-17 binary neutron star, and possibly a second binary neutron star. I say only possibly, only because the masses are such that it could in principle be a neutron star black hole system if you can somehow create quite light black holes. And of course, we have no real confirmation that it's not composed of fairly light black holes, unlike GW178-17, where the electromagnetic observations clearly demonstrate that there must have been significant matter involved. But at the very least, we've seen one or two binary neutron star mergers. Now, that means that the vast majority are binary black hole. There are, of course, a couple events which could be neutron star black hole mergers. And I think it'll be interesting to see if we can distinguish those at some point in the future. But it's safe to say that the majority of what we're seeing at the moment are all binary black hole mergers. So the question is what is creating these mergers? What kind of story can we tell from these? This is just a rough picture. You probably have all seen this now from the LIGO promotional materials. Just a picture showing the input black holes. They merge together and produce a final remnant one. And this just sort of shows the entire population that has been observed so far by the LIGO and Virgo collaborations. And you can see, it's basically all black holes at this point. But we can start to think about what the population is actually telling us and also what the outliers are telling us. So first of all, what can we learn about possibly the population and possibly how these things are forming? Now, I think a lot of theorists will probably yell at me for this kind of simplified sort of picture. And I think nowadays people are starting to talk about kind of other kinds of channels, which are in some sense related or some have some features of these different things. But I think broadly speaking, I'll be discussing basically two broad categories of how binary black hole mergers could form, roughly split into isolated binaries and dynamical formation. By isolated binaries, we mean that the stars actually formed roughly nearby in a binary system. And then at some point, they undergo a common envelope phase where there's a lot of gaseous matter around, which allows them to, by friction, to tighten the binary enough that it will actually be able to merge at that point in reasonable time by gravitational wave emission. The other kind of scenario is what we call a dynamical one. This is where you have in some sort of dense environment. By dense, I mean there's lots of black holes around, there's lots of stars around, there's lots of interaction between different binaries. And what that allows you to do is that you can have three-body interactions between, or even four-body interactions between two binaries, which preferentially will eject one of the objects and result in a tighter binary for the remaining two bodies. And by this way, you can create successively tighter and tighter binaries, eventually to the point where they will merge in a reasonable time. So these are both ways that we can get binary black holes that will merge in a sufficient time such that we could actually observe them by our gravitational wave detectors that we have currently. And there are other methods that are similar, but I think it's fair enough to say these are roughly two broad categories. Now, I'm going to talk about GW190521 itself and its discovery. So obviously, this was discovered back in May of 2019. What I'm plotting here are some pictures of what the data is looking like. So the top row in this right figure here is the Whiten time series of the data from each detector. And on top of that are what the signal model would look like based on standard parameter estimation, and also based on some unmodeled or loosely modeled techniques for trying to pick out what the coherent excess power looks like. And this was actually a relatively significant detection. It was identified by several low latency analyses, including ones targeting standard, what we call compact binary mergers. So they're really targeting black hole mergers and neutron star mergers. But also it was identified quite significantly by a sort of generic search, one known as CWB, which is really just looking for coherent excess power. It was also confirmed by several other analyses that were also running simultaneously. It was reported within a few minutes to observers. And since then, there have been observation campaigns to follow this up. Pertinent to that, I mean, it produced in low latency roughly an 800 square degree sky localization at fairly significant distance. But you know, this is enough that sort of large survey instruments do make an attempt to see if they have any EM counterparts there. Now, one of the interesting things to note about this event that may or may not be immediately obvious to people is if you actually look at the morphology of this signal, it's a bit different than a lot of the signals that have been sort of brought up and sort of been shown before. And one of the reasons for this is because it has very few cycles in it. It roughly looks slightly more symmetric in time, although it's not really. And the big reason for this is because it's simply higher mass. And the higher mass it will be within the LIGO observing band, it will get kind of compressed into fewer and fewer cycles. And we'll have this kind of morphology. In fact, this may not be apparent to many people, except to people who have really worked on LIGO data a lot, but if all you did was look at this bottom row of plots, which is showing a time frequency spectrogram of what the data looks like in each detector. If you just looked at this from one detector, this is actually looks fairly similar to what a lot of glitches and non-transient noise, instrumental noise, non-astrophysical noise, looks like in the detectors. The big difference here, though, is that it's happening coherently across the detector network. That's the really key thing, is that obviously this is not transient noise. This is an astrophysical event of very high significance. But if you were just to look at one detector, that would not have been obvious to most people, even people who study LIGO data, just based on a single detector. Now, what's really interesting about this event,
can I ask you a question? How many glitches per day like this do you see in detectors?
I think glitches per day is probably not the right unit. It's more like there's several per hour. Similar is kind of an interesting question. So when I mean there's several per hour, that's including a broader class of glitches that would not necessarily all be confused for this kind of event. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they would all have slightly different morphologies and would be confused with different kinds of binary systems. So if you're talking about specifically glitches that look very close to this event, such that it'd be exactly confused, I'm not sure what that rate is, but it would be significantly lower.
Yeah, so I mean, it's just that if you have a lot of glitches and eventually two of them are, because they have to coincide within a few milliseconds of each other, right?
So that's right. And it's more than actually, I mean, it's the timing coincidence, which provides the strong evidence, but it's actually somewhat more than that because there's also amplitude and phase coherence between the detectors. Right. Mm-hmm. And most of it is coming from the timing, but there's additional information that says this is really the same kind of event. But I mean, this is all part of how the statistical significance of these candidates are assessed.
Yeah, sure.
And so when you see things like the false alarm rates in the catalog reported, it's including the possibility that you get just two random glitches that happen to co-align.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
So I don't think there's really any concern that this is non-astrophysical. I think it's very clearly astrophysical. Now, if we look at the overall population of sources, 1905-21 is very interesting for a couple of reasons. One of the primary ones is because it's the highest mass source. And you can see this is roughly the population that's been observed so far, along with some of the ones they've highlighted that are particularly interesting. Now, that's very interesting. So one of the things that means is that we need to understand is this similar to the rest of the population? And if it differs, in what sort of ways? Now, 1905-21 is quite interesting because there's also the possibility of a potential electromagnetic counterpart. So I briefly referenced this before, but when these sky localizations are producing low latency, there are electromagnetic partners that will attempt to observe these regions and follow them up. One of the sort of survey facilities which is able to look at fairly large portions of the sky and is able to look at such large sky localizations, is the Tookie Transient Facility. And people analyzed that data following this particular event and found in spatial coincidence, meaning that roughly in the right sky location, roughly at the right distance, at least in agreement with the low latency localization, they found a flare that corresponds to a known AGN. And this would be particularly exciting because if this really were coming from a common source, then we've really pinned down what the formation environment of this particular event was. And obviously looking at AGN, near an AGN is an area where you can have a high density in principle of black holes and could be an area where dynamical formation is possible. And so it is the kind of environment which might be very interesting to how these binary black holes that we're observing form. And it's also the kind of environment, of course, that would require, to actually have an electromagnetic counterpart, you need to have a fairly large amount of gaseous matter around to interact with. So and that's one of the reasons why most of the time when we talk about binary black holes, we don't really expect to find an electromagnetic counterpart. Because if these things have been evolving for a long period in an isolated manner, any matter that would have been around would be essentially long gone. But if you have an accretion disk nearby, after the merger, there'll be a kick, and which allows you an opportunity to interact with this accretion disk. And the basic model is that through this interaction, the flare is then produced. That provides an exciting possibility down the line, because there's also the idea proposed in the original paper that if this is the case, there may be a recurrence of the flare as you get another interaction. So this is a potentially very interesting counterpart. Now, 1905-21 is very interesting for another reason. And that's because its particular masses are somewhat unusual. It's obviously it's the heaviest solar masses, but there's some critical values here that are kind of key. And what it looks like, this is from the original LIGO-Virgo analyses. They found roughly that the primary mass is around 85 solar masses. The secondary is roughly around 66 solar masses. And one of the key findings that they have is that there's roughly 90 to 99% probability. The range depends on the exact model of the signal they use. That at least one of the black holes is in the range 65 to 120 solar masses. Now, that's an interesting range because that range is very difficult to produce as a direct remnant of a supernova. Now, there have since been lots of papers trying to propose different ways you could do such a thing, but at least the prevailing idea has been that there should, in fact, not be black hole remnants in this mass range, roughly between 50 and 120 solar masses. Again, the boundaries are a little bit fuzzy. And the reason for this is because there's an instability that occurs at particular masses of the initial star, and essentially the supernova becomes violent enough to not leave behind enough matter to have a remnant. And if you're seeing something in this mass range, well, it means one of two things. Either, well, all of those models are wrong, or this formed in a different way. It didn't form as the merger of two supernova remnants. And one of the ways that you can do that is through a system of a set of hierarchical mergers. So you have supernova remnants at lower masses, which merge and then interact again with another black hole or another set over time, which then keep merging in a sort of successive generations of mergers. And so in this model, the primary very well could be a second generation merger, for example. And so that would be a very exciting result, because it would really demonstrate one that this has to be a sort of dynamical formation, and it demonstrates that this kind of model is even possible at significant rates. Okay, so when we saw this result, we really came up with two questions that we actually wanted to answer. The first is, how consistent are the locations of the observed EM flare with the gravitational wave observation? And the second is, if they do in fact come from a common source, does this affect what we infer about the common source parameters? Now, this is what we started off with. It's obviously not quite where we ended up, but I think we'll get to there as in due time. Now, with that, I'm going to pass it off to my colleague to discuss basically how we try to go about answering these kinds of questions before we get to our results from our paper.
Okay, thanks, Alex. I'll spend the next few minutes first off saying how we did our analysis and just providing a very quick review and background of Bayesian inference, how we do this in gravitational wave astronomy. And then I'll talk about the results that we got. First of all, just as a recap, what sort of parameters can we look to measure from a binary black hole merger? You've got the two component masses, M1 and M2. And in our analyses, we generally use the definition that M1, the mass one, is the larger of the two objects. And then each of those two masses can be spinning. And so that adds 6 degrees of freedom to your problem. You've got the spin orientation on each object and then the magnitude of the spins. And should note also, if the spins of either one of the components are misaligned with the orbital angular momentum, then you get orbital precession that happens. And that has an effect on the gravitational wave, which we'll see in a minute. And then you have 6 degrees of freedom for the location and orientation of the binary. So you've got the sky location given by the right ascension and declination, and then the distance to the source. And then there's also the inclination, which here we define as the angle between the line of sight and the orbital angular momentum at some fiducial gravitational wave frequency. In our analysis, that frequency was set to 20 hertz. And then you have just the orbital phase and polarization, which essentially just describes the orientation of the binary's frame with respect to the observer frame. And those are the degrees of freedom you have if you have a circular orbits. You could also have eccentric orbits, in which case you pick up additional degrees of freedom. However, in this analysis, and actually in the LVC analysis and most analyses, we assume circular orbits. There's a good astrophysical reason for that. If you assume that this binary was born together, and then by the time you get to the point where they're close to merger, where we can measure the gravitational wave, and the eccentricity has sort of been radiated away, and so you expect circular orbits. Although that may not be true if you have a more dynamical capture scenario where you have, say, a globular cluster and the larger mass captured the smaller mass, but we don't consider that scenario here, at least from the eccentricity perspective. Now, each of these parameters has an effect on the gravitational wave. And so by measuring the gravitational wave, the frequency evolution, the phase evolution, and the amplitude evolution, you can infer what these parameters are. And to demonstrate that, I have this movie here. So here we show it, what the observed gravitational wave would be for some source. I'm going to change the parameters of the source to see, so you can see what happens to the gravitational wave for different parameter values. So if I play this, so as I increase the spin on each of the objects, you can see that changes the gravitational wave. If I change the orientation, now I'm starting to introduce precession. And in particular, if I now change the orientation angle, I wasn't fast enough to pause it. Let me play that again. If I put the spins in the plane, and then especially if I change the inclination angle with respect to the line of sight, you can see that you really start to see these fluctuations in the amplitude more, and so you're measuring the you can see precession more. Yeah, you can really see it here. So this would be a precessing binary that you're observing edge on, and you can like see these effects in the waveform. So how do we actually go and pull out these, tease out what these parameter values are given some data and observed data? Well, for that we use Bayes' theorem. So I'm sure many of you are familiar with this, but I'll just quickly review. And so if you have some set of parameters, which I'm representing here as theta, so say the two masses, the two spins, et cetera, and you have some observed data D, you want to know what the probability is that the signal has those particular parameters. And that's this PDF on the left here. And so to evaluate that, you use Bayes' theorem to deconstruct this posterior distribution into a likelihood times a prior divided by the evidence. And the prior is your prior belief as to what is the probability that a signal could have those particular set of parameter values. The likelihood is the thing that you actually measure, the probability that you actually measure from the data. And then you have this evidence term in the denominator. And that term, you can kind of see it as if you marginalize over all the parameter, the entire prior space, if you marginalize the likelihood times the prior over that entire space, then that essentially gives you the evidence. And this evidence is basically a normalization constant. And what's useful about it, though, is if you have two models for that you think could describe the thing that you're trying to observe, then you can calculate a evidence for each of those two models and then take the ratio of those two things. And then that gives you what's called the Bayes factor. And this essentially quantifies how much probability there is for one model as opposed to the other model. So in this case here, if I had a Bayes factor greater than one, then that would mean model B is favored over model A. And we're gonna use that later on to evaluate the likelihood that the 190521 came from the EM flare. Like I said before, you have this major term, the likelihood, and this is really the likelihood is where the data and the waveform model come into this. And you have to, when you calculate the likelihood, you have to make some assumption about your waveform, your signal model, and you have to make an assumption about the noise that the detectors output if you don't have any signal in there. The standard thing in gravitational wave astronomy is to assume that in the absence of a signal, the detector output stationary Gaussian noise. And under that assumption, then you can do some math. You can show that the log likelihood is given by this sum of inner products. And this is an inner product between the residuals. So basically, you have some model for the waveform given some set of parameters. You generate that model, you subtract it from the data, and then you calculate this weighted inner product that's given by this, this integral in the bottom part here. And this integral is weighted by the inverse power of spectral density. And that's plotted here for each of the three detectors. And this is basically a measure of the average amount of power from the noise as a function of frequency in the detectors. And so this gives you essentially an algorithmic way to go and calculate the posterior probability. So if I have some point in parameter space, so here I'm plotting M1 and M2 on the left, and I have some point given by the orange dot here. I can generate a waveform for that. So that's given by the yellow line over here on the right, and the light blue is my data. And so then I subtract the yellow line from the data essentially, and then I calculate my weighted inner product, and then that gives me a likelihood from which I can calculate a posterior probability, and that's represented by the height here. Now that's just a point estimate of the posterior. We really want to map out the entire surface to get that measurement of what the probability is. And so to do that, we generally use stochastic samplers. Generally, we'll either use an MCMC or a nested sampler. Here I have an animation just to quickly show like is basically how an MCMC anyway works. So again, same plots that I was showing before, but here now I've stuck down a whole bunch of points on the surface, and each one of these points I have a waveform here on the right, and the color is proportionate to their likelihood. And so now if I play this, you can see you evolve the sampler forward in time, and eventually it locks on to what the most likely signal parameters are. And then from the resultant distribution of points, sorry about this, you get a posterior distribution, which then you can marginalize over to get some estimates for particular parameter values. So here, this would be M1 and M2. And this is specifically for not 190521. This is from just an example from 150914. This was the first detected binary black hole. You know, you can get estimates for the masses, other things like the distance and inclination, and also the sky location. Really anything you want from those parameter values that describe the binary. And so that's the basics to how we actually go about measuring some of the parameters. So now how do we essentially took this machinery that we had and apply it to 190521 to try and get some parameter values. And the thing that we, as Alex mentioned before, when we started out this project, the thing that we were really looking to do was try to evaluate what is the likelihood that 1905-21 came from the same source as the EM flare that was observed by ZTF. And to do that, we want to evaluate the Bayes factor. Before that, we first needed sort of a baseline thing to compare to. So we redid the parameter estimation analysis without assuming that the source, that 1905-21 came from the EM source, just to get a baseline set of values for the parameters that we would then compare to. And that's what we started to do. But when we did this, we actually got some unexpected results off the bat. And one of the first things that we found was the likelihood surface for this event was much more complicated than things that we've evaluated in the past. In particular, there were some crazy sort of relationships between the various angles, like the polarization, the phase, and the inclination, that it was a really complicated likelihood surface. You can see that here. So on the left is showing those three angles, and each one of these points represents a point from one of our early analyses. It's a point in that produced by our stochastic sampler in our parameter space. And you can see you have, like, for instance, between polarization and phase, you have this kind of crazy crosshatch pattern. And this sort of thing is very difficult for a sampler to properly sample and to really give you a good measure of the true posterior distribution. And so to try and help with this, we ended up introducing some numerical marginalization. First, we did this on the polarization to try and simplify the problem. But even when we did that, we still had some crazy relationships between, in this case, the phase and the inclination, and that's shown on the right here. You can see you still have this kind of double helix pattern in the likelihood surface. And again, this is still very difficult for a sampler to sample. So we introduced some additional numerical marginalization over the inclination, and then that made this, sorry, not over the inclination, over the phase. And then this made it simplified the problem enough that we were able to get good stable results from our analysis, from our sampler. So what was our analysis? And we used a software package called PyCBC Inference that both Alex and I have developed over several years with a nested sampler called Dynasty. It's a, you can go and download it from GitHub. It's an off the shelf sampler. We use two different waveform models. I'll discuss this a bit more in a minute, but there's different waveform models out there to describe what these gravitational waves should look like based on some set of parameters. Here we used two waveform models. One is a phenomenological fit to numerical relativity called IMR Phenomics PHM. The other one is a different sort of fit to numerical relativity called it's a NR surrogate. Both of these are quite good. The one thing about the NR surrogate model is it's only been calibrated to lower mass ratio simulations. And so it can only really be used up to mass ratios of about 6 to 1. And that's going to improve significant in a minute, and we'll see that. Again, both of these models assume circular orbits. For our priors in our analysis, we use kind of standard priors. Given what we know about astrophysics. So for our distance prior, basically we used a prior uniform and co-moving volume. And for orientation, we used isotropic and sky location. For the spins, we used a prior that was isotropic in orientation for each of the spins and then uniform in magnitude. We also used a prior that was isotropic in orientation. By orientation, I'm talking about the inclination angle. We tried out two mass priors. So in one prior, we used a prior that was uniform in source frame total mass and uniform in mass ratio, where again, mass ratio is defined as being greater than or equal to 1. And we also tried a prior that was uniform in source frame component masses. And this was just to see how our prior on our masses affect our result. So what are the results that we got? This is a plot comparing what we get when we use our two different mass priors. On the left here, we have a plot showing what our posterior distribution, our marginalized posterior distribution on each of the component masses was in the system. The blue line, the blue contours here show our credible, our 90 and 50% credible regions for when we assume a prior that's uniform in source frame total mass and mass ratio. And then the green shows what happens when we assume uniform in source frame component masses. Oh, I should mention, so I'm saying source frame versus detector frame. Because the universe is expanding, as a gravitational wave travels from the source to the detector, the gravitational wave gets redshifted. And that has an effect on what the masses that we measure here at on Earth are. Basically, the masses get increased by a factor of 1 plus z. So we really want to know what the actual source masses were. So to do that, we have to assume a cosmology. We just assume a standard cosmology using values from the Planck 2015. And so that's why I say specifically source frame masses. The orange regions here show that Pisin mass graph, the apparent stability supernova mass gap that Alex mentioned earlier. And the key thing here that you can see is that we essentially have a multimodal distribution in our posterior. And this is a bit different than what the LIGO-Virgo collaboration initially reported. The LVC collaboration basically just found this this one mode that's closer to the equal mass ratio line. I don't know if you can see my cursor or not. It's the thing closer to the black region up here. But we, and you can see that one is like right smack dab in the middle of that Pisin mass gap. However, we find the second mode, which is at a higher mass ratio and consequently is out of this mass gap. Basically, the mode here is around 170 solar masses to a 16 solar mass. And the black cross here actually shows our maximum likelihood waveform. And I'll speak more about that in a second, but I should just also mention with the other plots here. And the middle plot here is sort of just re-plotting these mass just in terms of total mass and mass ratio, just to give you a different perspective on that. And then the plot over here on the right is showing what the spin posterior is. So basically the angle here is representing the angle between the spin vector and the orbital angular momentum. So 0 degrees represents the spin on the larger object is aligned with the orbital angular momentum. 90 degrees would be in the plane in sort of maximal precession. You can see then the posterior is kind of centered around 135 degrees. So that means basically roughly between face away, anti-aligned with the orbital angular momentum and in the plane. Like I said, the cross here represents our maximum likelihood waveform. So if we replot this thing, where here we're showing each of the samples in our posterior, now they're colored by basically the signal to noise ratio, which is a measurement of just the likelihood surface. This is without assuming any sort of prior. This is just the pure likelihood, i.e. the signal to noise ratio. And you can see that the SNR is really actually, not only do we have these multi-modes, but the SNR is peaking at the higher mass ratio mode, the mode that we found that the LVC did not find, and that is consistent with the Pisin mass gap. And that's this yellow region here. And in fact, the maximum likelihood waveform parameters, the two masses were basically 170 solar masses to 16 solar masses. So even though you get, you have maybe if you, going back, if you assume the uniform and source frame component masses, you kind of get equal probability at this equal mass ratio versus high mass ratio mode. And you only really see it zero in on the high mass ratio mode if you assume the uniform and total mass and mass ratio prior. You know, you have these two modes that are kind of equal probability, but if you look at just the pure likelihood, it's actually peaking at the higher mass ratio mode. We also did some waveform comparisons between these two modes just to see, make sure that there wasn't anything crazy going on here. So here I've plotted two waveforms. The orange line corresponds to the cross. So this was our maximum likelihood waveform. The blue line corresponds to the more equal mass ratio one, and this is more consistent with what the LVC found. And you can see that the waveforms are fairly similar to each other. The black lines shows the whitened strain, the actual data from each of the detectors, and you can see it matches the data quite well. But again, the orange line, the higher mass ratio one, we get a bit more signal and noise ratio out of it.
Can I ask you a quick question? Sorry.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
If I look at Virgo, it seems that the significance is quite lower. I know you showed also before the sensitivity is a bit worse. But in this case, is it due to the position in the sky or is a typical difference in sensitivity of the experiments?
It's typical difference to the sensitivity.
Okay.
This is a whitened strain. So basically, we've taken the data and we've weighted it by the sensitivity of the instrument. So that's why it looks much weaker in Virgo.
Okay, thanks.
You could get some orientations where you would get a lot, despite the weaker sensitivity of Virgo, you would get actually a louder signal. But it's a very, you know, rare parts in the sky. You'd have to have a pretty rare orientation for that. So.
Okay, thanks.
Yep. I want to get, I'm not sure how much time we have, so I'm going to skip this next slide about subdominant harmonics, but if people have some questions.
Another quick question. So if you use some other waveform models, do you also recover this bimodal distribution?
Very good question. And that's actually a nice segue. I was just about to talk about that. So.
Okay.
So I'm going to skip this bit about subdominant harmonics, but if anybody has any questions about this later, we can come back to it. Actually answering that question. So we also did our analysis using that NR surrogate model that I mentioned before. And this is the result we get for that. I'm just showing here, if you assume the prior that's uniform in mass ratio and total mass. And yes, you can see you get this, still get this multimodal distribution in masses. However, recall that I said that this model doesn't model mass ratios above mass ratio 6. And that's represented by this gray shaded region here. So that's kind of the edge of where the model of parameter space that the model can give you results for. And you can see that you're getting the second mode, but it's like bumpied right up against the edge of the model's sort of validity, space of validity. So what this would suggest is if we had a model, an NR surrogate model that went to higher mass ratios, we could potentially end up getting also the same sort of second mode at this higher mass ratio of with the other result, we had something around 11. So yes, we do kind of see this multimodal distribution with other approximant, and we're going to mention this at the end, really we need some more waveform models at this higher mass ratio and also high spin region to sort of really understand this result better. So with that, that's basically our baseline results. And I'm going to turn it back over to Alex now to talk about what happened when we now try to evaluate whether or not this also came from the EM flare.
Yeah, I think we're running short on time, so I'll try to keep this short. I think we said at the beginning, one of the original things we actually wanted to know was this event consistent with the observed EM flare? So we didn't abandon that. And the way we approached that is we have these estimates that assume sort of standard gravitation wave priors for sort of standard situations for a population. But we also have the sky location and the redshift of the observed flare. So what we can do is we can calculate the evidence for a model that's constrained to the location of the observed flare and for one that is isotropic in the sky. And so we repeat the parameter estimation under the assumption of a common source where we fix to the observed flare location. And this is just a quick summary of the results. And I'll maybe just give you the highlights here. Broadly speaking, you get relatively similar results to what we saw when you have an isotropic sort of where you have a standard gravitational prior where they're not necessarily a common source with a couple of key differences. So one of the primary ones is that the highest mass ratio region that was at mass ratio roughly around 11 is actually somewhat disfavored now. And the reason for this is that it's actually quite a tight constraint that AGN of the observer of flare is at a very specific redshift. And that redshift constraint actually is not consistent with our highest mass ratio region, because the highest mass ratio region actually corresponds to a source that would be too close to correspond well to that AGN. And so what actually ends up happening is that more of the support ends up shifting to roughly a mass ratio of 5 to 6 mode. This still has obviously significant support. In fact, some of the support also shifts from the lowest mass ratio mode to, you know, basically has still a significant support outside of the region that would be caused by the parametric instability supernova. But if this flare can be really validated and is really a true common source, then this would indicate quite strongly that that the mass parameters are probably more like a mass ratio of 5 to 6. Now that's very exciting, because what that means is that really we're actually learning quite a lot by having these sort of follow-up events, especially if this turns out to be a true relationship. It'll be very interesting in the future to see how many more of these kinds of events that we'll see. Now, we want to evaluate, well, how likely is this really to be a true relationship? And we took into account a couple things into this. For our analysis, we're really going to just focus on how consistent are the sky location and the distance. So notably, that does not include the timing coincidence. There's a lot of model uncertainties related to the timing coincidence. And if you want to know more about that, I suggest taking a look at the original paper and some of the stuff that is followed out from there. But for this analysis, we've been somewhat conservative and we're just looking at the spatial coincidence itself. The other thing is that we're going to look at a range, basically two limiting assumptions for the manner in which these observations are actually carried out. Because it matters quite a lot if the observation is basically saying that there are no other AGNs flares within the observed volume in the entire span of the sky, or if they're only looking at the region that roughly corresponds to the area of the low latency localization, which they got to follow up to begin with. So these serve as sort of the two bounding cases. And if you assume that really ZTF has observed basically the entire sky and was not biased by the low latency alert that they received, then, and this is the most favorable assumption, then we find that the natural log base factor is only 2.3 in favor. That's not normally considered particularly significant. The other thing that's a fairly significant caveat to that is we haven't included any trials factors in regards to how many observations are taking place for the entire population of binary black holes. So this is in some sense giving it a favorable interpretation that, well, maybe you only expect to see an EM association for things that have this kind of total mass. And this is obviously a population outlier. But if you were to take into account that essentially the large population of black holes are in fact followed up, all of these base factors get significantly worse. If you take the other range of assumptions where you assume that you only followed up the low latency region, the base factor is also much worse on its own. It goes down to -4. And sort of given this range, it's unfortunate, but really, you know, there's not really any strong support from the spatial localization that these things really come from a common source. Now, we can't rule it out strongly either. So I don't want people to take that away, but really it's mostly uninformative, unfortunately. And the sort of model selection, the sort of systematic effects in how these observations take account and the different models mean that there's really not a clear association or not. I think the primary thing that's going to be of interest is whether this flare can be corroborated in a way that's consistent only with the explanation of a binary black hole merger. Now, there's, as I said, mentioned earlier, there's the possibility that there could be a recurrence of the flare as there's additional interactions with the disk. And if those are observed to be consistent with the binary black hole merger, that would be, I think, significant evidence in favor of the association. And, you know, in time telling, hope, you know, we'll see if that pans out or not. Now,
a quick question. So if you also include the time coincidence, do you think that will improve the base factor or?
So that depends on who you ask on the models for what the timing should be. I think if you use some of the assumptions from the original paper, it should improve the Bayes factor. But there's been a number that argue that this is maybe not such a strong claim. So I think in general, there's enough uncertainty here that if you want to always choose the favorable knob in every direction, you can get a positive Bayes factor. If you always choose the conservative one, you get strongly disfavoring. So I think the unfortunate situation is that there's really not a clear answer at the moment. It's not quite the answer we wanted. We were hoping for something a little bit more concrete, but I think at the moment, there's really not going to be a concrete answer about from just the information we have at the moment.
So the other question is, even if, let's say, in a year you observe another flare, I mean, it's possible that it's not still not from binary black hole hitting the disk. It's just some active AGM. It's in the active period. So, I mean,
the key thing is going to come about if I completely agree with your point, which is that it could be just a repeating flare, which in principle could have other mechanisms. The key thing that is going to, I think, help or hinder is how much they can pin down the prediction for what the period of recurrence should be. If there's too much uncertainty in that, then I agree, that might wash out as well.
Okay.
Okay, so just to maybe emphasize some of the implications, we've seen support for higher mass ratio modes. If you choose the sort of prior that's uniform in component masses, we get roughly equal support between the lowest mass ratio modes and all the higher mass ratio modes, which means that it's not necessarily impossible that parametric instability, this gap region could be violated, but it's not necessary either. One of the results out of the parameters that we're getting is that it is still kind of suggestive that this is probably formed through dynamical formation. And this comes about because the spin on the dominant object when you go to the higher mass ratio modes is actually somewhat more constrained to be anti-aligned with the orbital angular momentum, which is somewhat easier to produce if it comes about through dynamical formation. And just to reiterate, if there really is a common origin, it actually has quite a strong impact on what the mass parameters of this source are. And that's because it really pins down the distance, which couples into the mass estimates. And in fact, it somewhat rules out the highest mass ratio mode we see, but it still allows for both the low mass ratio mode and a mode sitting around a mass ratio of 5 to 6. With that, I'm gonna pass it back to Colin to discuss how our results are different and compared to some of the prior results and touch on some of the systematics.
I'll try and do this really quickly. As Alex had mentioned earlier, and if you're familiar with the original paper or analysis that was done by the LVC, they had these different set of masses. They reported mass of essentially 85 and 66, which if true would be a violation of the Pisan mass gap and may suggest a hierarchical merger or that the Pisan mass gap isn't actually true. So then why do we have these differences from our analysis compared to theirs? It's hard to make exact apples to apples comparisons because there were several differences between our analysis and theirs. One of which was we used slightly different waveform models. We did use a common model in the NR surrogate, but as we saw, that model cuts out at mass ratio 6, and so you can't really fully evaluate the higher mass ratio mode. Probably the most comparable one to the phenomenological model that we used is this PhenomPV3HM thing. The XPHM one that we used was a little bit more of an up-to-date one. It's been calibrated to some more numerical waveforms and has some additional improvements in it. So I would say I would be a little bit more confident in the XPHM results probably. They also use SEOBNR. This is an effective one-body model that we did not use. The other thing is they had different sampling methods. They used a different basically code base to do it. And they also didn't introduce any of the numerical marginalization over phase and polarization that we did that we found that was necessary. They also use different priors. So remember I mentioned the masses, when you go from the source to the detector frame, get redshifted to higher mass, basically. We use, even in our uniform and component mass prior, we were using uniform and source frame component mass, whereas the LVC was using uniform and detector frame component mass. And they also use, for their volume prior, they use uniform in the cube of the luminosity distance rather than uniform and co-moving volume. And then finally, they applied some cuts to their analysis in parameter space. They put some cuts on, they insisted that the observed detector frame total mass had to be larger than 200 solar masses. That the chirp frame, chirp mass had to be between 70 and 150 solar masses, and a few other cuts that we list here. And so to try to understand maybe why we were seeing these differences compared to the LVC, we made these plots here. So here on the left, I'm showing the detector frame masses, the posterior on the detector frame masses, and on the right, the source frame masses. And the blue contours correspond to the LVC results. The dark blue is what they got when they use the NR surrogate. The light blue is what they got when they use the phenomenological model. And the green line is our result. And then the brown line is what we get when we apply the same cuts and parameter space that the LVC did. And that's represented by these gray shaded regions. And you can see in particular, because of those cuts that they applied, they effectively excised the bit where that higher mass ratio mode was, and especially due to the chirp mass cut, which is given by the dotted line. And so they basically kind of excised the maximum likelihood region from their analysis. Now, why did they end up doing that? And we think probably what happened is they didn't realize that second mode was there. You can see the brown line here is what we get when we apply the same cuts to our analysis. You can see that we still kind of have a hint of a second mode there. But this is using still a uniform and co-moving volume and source frame masses. It turns out if you switch to the prior that they used that was uniform in detector frame masses and uniform in cubic luminosity distance, you end up disfavoring that second mode even more. And so probably what ended up happening is they started out with this prior, they did a quick initial evaluation, they thought the likelihood was trailing off at the high mass ratio end, and so they thought it was okay to use these cuts to probably help speed up their analysis. Now, I don't know if that's the case. We're not in LIGO. We weren't involved with that analysis. This is just a guess, but it does seem to be probably what happened. Regardless, the short answer is if you repeated LVC analysis because of those parameter space cuts, you would not see that maximum likelihood waveform, that higher mass ratio mode. And so that's the short answer. That's the main reason why you don't see that in their analysis. So to wrap things up, we want to emphasize that, so we have this interesting result that, you know, potentially this was actually more like a 11 to 1 mass ratio event that's consistent with the Pisan mass gap, but would also mean that you've got this, you know, 170 solar mass black hole that has high spin that's anti-aligned and sort of pointing down away from the orbital plane. So you do have to still try and understand astrophysically if that's true, how could that happen? But we also want to emphasize that the waveform models in this area of parameter space, we really need more waveform models in this area of parameter space. And especially at the moment, there are no models that include both high precession, high mass ratio, and eccentricity. And so that's another factor in here that, you know, it probably really needs to be factored in to fully understand this event. And so our hope is that there'll be some more studies in this, in particular, some more NR waveforms simulations at these parameter space values, so we can have a better understanding of what this event is. Admittedly, the reason why there aren't that many waveforms here is this is a very hard type of system to model. So there is a lot of work to be done here, but there's potentially more physics to learn about from this event. And with that, I want to say thank you. And we'll leave our result plot up on the screen and ask any questions.
Thanks very much, Colin and Alex, for a great talk. Do we have any questions?
So I can ask a question. So you said that you don't have good models for this mass ratio, but I mean, how about these EMRI models? Because I mean, you are getting close to this, I guess, extreme mass ratio. Is this not extreme enough?
Yeah, it's not really extreme enough. It's kind of in the in-between zone where it's not, yeah.
Okay.
We should maybe clarify what you mean by not great models at this mass ratio. So certain parts of the models are relatively well understood. So for example, the dominant modes are relatively well understood, even at very high mass ratio, even up to the sort of EMRI, sort of transitioning over to more EMRI models. Mm-hmm. What gets more difficult is understanding the confluence of basically precession in addition to the subdominant harmonics. And in particular for this event, we want to emphasize, I mean, there are some papers out there, for example, that are suggesting alternate explanations for this particular event that include an eccentric binary. And the really big unknown is not any of those things that we just mentioned, but is actually being able to bring together both precession and an eccentric binary into a single model. There are no models at the moment, even really preliminary ones, that include both eccentricity and precession in a consistent way. And so that's really a kind of big unknown that we're not really going to be able to fully answer without fairly significant investment from both the numerical relativity and the modeling community to try to bridge that gap. And to be clear, I mean, what people have sort of done at the moment is they've taken either a few eccentric numerical relativity simulations and kind of tried to dot the space a bit, or they've taken some preliminary models that are really missing a lot of physics. To try to see if it might also be consistent. So I would say a lot of the eccentric results are very preliminary, but possibly interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think really we're going to want to have some model that combines these so we can really differentiate in a robust way what is really going to be preferred in this case. I think that's...
Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
Yeah, I just want to say one thing about... Yeah, so just for a reference point, Alex brings up a good point. But I mean, if this was a non-spinning system, like there's a lot of waveforms up to like mass ratio 18 to 1, 20 to 1, but it's really just the combination of these things. I mean, 11 to 1, if this was non-spinning, isn't that really difficult or that unknown. It's just really the combination of the things.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. So from some of your last slides, I got the impression that sort of the crucial difference between your analysis and the LVC analysis, or the reason why they didn't see any hint of this higher mass ratio mode, was essentially that they assumed these priors that are uniform in the detector frame. So is there any like intrinsic reason to assume these kind of priors? Because astrophysics, I would sort of more think in terms of the priors that you assume that are uniform in the source frame rather than in the detector frame. So is there any sort of intrinsic reason to assume this?
I think the main reason is historical. A lot of the codes were developed back when we weren't worried about detecting things at cosmological distances. So, you know, things are developed just using uniform in the observed masses and just assuming cubic and distance. And so basically what they will do, and if you read the properties paper, they start with that prior and then they'll reweight their posterior samples to like uniform and co-moving volume to check that it doesn't change the results that much. And they even say it doesn't change the values that much, which is true if you just had the single mode. The problem is once you've already done the analysis, if you don't have the posterior samples in that other region, no amount of reweighting is going to tell you about those additional samples. So yeah, I mean, certainly it makes more sense to use a uniform and co-moving volume. And if you're going to do uniform in masses, do uniform in source frame masses. But I think it was mostly just a historical reason. One other thing I want to mention here, it's not crazy. So seeing multi-modes in the mass posterior like this, this is really unusual. Like it surprised us. We've analyzed a lot of events and we've not seen this before. And it just turns out that for these particular set of parameter values, and we check this with a simulation, this is what happens. But I mean, usually what you end up seeing is just a single mode. So it's not crazy that, you know, they would have just seen the single mode and thought, oh, okay, everything's fine here. And really, I mean, we mostly got lucky that we happened across that extra mode.
So you said you when you perform the sampling, you marginalize over the polarization angles and some other angles. Do you think whether this procedure will change the result? So let's say if you don't do that, do you expect much difference or not?
Well, you shouldn't get a difference because the numerical the marginalization is, that's what you want to do. Because if you just want to know what the masses are, you're marginalizing out all the other parameters. It may be that you would have gotten a different result. Certainly we were getting different results. That's why we did it. But that doesn't mean that those results were real. It was just that if you don't do that extra marginalization step, at least for the sampler that we were using, it really struggled to get the correct posterior. And the reason I say correct is because we know that if you just change the starting seed for the sampler, you would get completely different results. So this was something that we needed to do in order to get stable results. Whether or not the fact that the LVC didn't do that marginalization, whether or not that was a factor in their results, I have no idea, because again, they were using a different code base and a different sampling technique.
Okay.
So we have some members of the LVC in this audience. Are they going to comment?
Yeah, so Reed has a question.
Yeah, hey, Colin, hey, Alex. Thanks for the nice overview of your results. So I think that your diagnosis of, you know, the prior cuts coming into play here is reasonable. Although I don't have any definitive proof of it, I don't think that there were any convergence issues with the LSC samplers. The degeneracies you guys pointed out, I believe that they're in the models, right? So they're pretty generic. But I don't know whether people had to do anything special. I don't think that anything special was done in the analyses. I was hoping to pick your guys' brain about a slightly different question, though, if you don't mind. Just thoughts were about the 03 RNP paper, which claims that this event isn't necessarily an outlier in the overall distribution that we find. The Fischbach and Holtz paper, which you guys, I know you cite in your paper, that did just reweight LSC samples, but actually found when you use an astrophysical prior, a tail sort of to the more extreme mass ratios near the mode that you guys point out. Anyway, I'm just curious about your impressions about that stuff.
Okay, well, I can go first here, Colin, if you like. Yeah. So first about the rates and population paper. So I just want to be clear that when we said that this is an outlier, we more mean in the sense that it's the largest by some metric, in this case, total mass, which I think we can probably all agree on. When you mean that it's not an outlier in terms of a specific population, that certainly could be true, especially if it's consistent with the sort of dominant mode. And in particular, you're referencing sort of the different population models, which the rates of population paper went through. And so I think that's all relatively at least self-consistent. It would be somewhat different if you were to consider, for example, the higher mass ratio mode, if that were in some sense the most plausible. I think it would be a little bit harder to explain, because then you, Colin touched upon this a little bit, but you do need a somewhat different understanding to explain a gap when you get to a very high primary mass. You'd still have this somewhat non-continuous distribution, not necessarily in the total masses, but in the individual component masses. And in particular, the primary mass, at the very high mass ratio, goes up to about 170. So you would still have this kind of gap. So it would still be consistent if you had sort of a multi-component model of the population. But I don't think there's anything particularly inconsistent in terms of what the LSC is reporting internally. And I would say one thing I really liked about that paper is it seemed like you guys were very careful in terms of how you handle these kinds of outliers in terms of the population statements. And I think it's very nice to actually to see how you guys have basically have the population statements repeated for, like, I think 1908-14 in and out, and also 1905-21 in and out. And a lot of the statements are robust to that, it seems.
Yeah, and that's actually what my question was about, right? So that as you pointed out, that people did leave one out analyses, sanity checks. And so, again, I don't have any proof of this, but I'm going to tend to disagree with you about needing a multi-component model to catch the high mass ratio or the asymmetric mass ratio mode. And that's mostly driven by the fact that when Maya and Daniel just reweighted their samples with something that was like a population-informed model, even before they imposed a cut on M2 being small, they found support up to that. So the RNP paper is going to use a similar model, that's going to push the distribution that way, and that they found it to be consistent. So I don't have any proof that, again, as you guys pointed out, like, the LSC samples don't pick up on this exact likelihood.
And you very well could be right if your population model allows some support out to somewhat arbitrarily high masses, so it's, doesn't decay very quickly. I mean, you can easily explain a single outlier out of now 100 black holes as being part of a larger population. Assuming that you have exactly a model that allows that, then yeah, that's still plausible, I think.
Right, and that that's one of the main conclusions from the R&D paper, is that there's no longer a perfectly sharp cutoff at 45. It's some tail. And that's actually driven by more than just 0521. There are a few other events that sort of like the peak above where the cutoff was. And that's one of the reasons, as you pointed out, why the statement that it's not an outlier and that it doesn't fail is robust against, taking this one sample.
Yeah, and I think, obviously the best proof in the pudding will be once we have a lot more events. And I think the most exciting thing in our field at the moment is that, especially once we start looking towards 04, we're going to have many times this number of events. So, the statistics of previous runs will keep getting blown out every time.
Yeah, agreed. I'm sorry if I got to cut you off. I don't know, Colin, if you wanted to respond in any way. I didn't mean to jump in too much.
No, that's fine. I think Alex covered it. I guess the one thing, I think with the Fischbach and Holtz paper, they were the only thing is, they were reweighting the samples that the LVC had, and because there were no samples up there, if you don't have any samples, there's only so much reweighting you can do. I would be curious. We didn't try to use the prior that they did, but you could try and we've made our posterior samples available. You can download them from GitHub. So you could try and do the same thing that they did and see what result you get with having the samples up at the even higher mass ratio mode.
Okay, thanks. Any final questions? Okay, if that's not the case, then let's thank Colin and Alex again for a great seminar. Thanks very much.
Thank you, guys.
See you all next week.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.